Your name?
Jamila Larson.
Your organization?
The Homeless Children's Playtime Project.
Which is?
An organization where volunteers come into DC homeless shelters and transitional housing programs and set up playrooms, creating safe spaces for children to have kind of an oasis from the stress of shelter living. And then we fill these play spaces with books and toys and dedicated and trained volunteers that can provide one-on-one attention to children once or twice a week, eight programs each week across DC.
I think a lot of folks maybe can't realize some of the stress that's involved with being in a shelter. How important is it for these kids to get a little time, for the parents to get a little time where their kids are being looked after and they're comfortable, their kids are safe and learning and so on?
Mm-hmm. It's incredibly important for every child, no matter what their circumstances are, to have downtime after school, to have a chance to decide what they want to do, you know, curl up with a book, play a board game, draw a picture. And children who live in shelters are often denied the basic human right to play because their rooms are so cramped, they don't have their own books and toys, and they have to live in an institution sharing communal living space. So to be able to have an outlet where they can actually be kids and not worry about their situation for a couple hours is invaluable. We give kids the opportunity to run around, to creatively express themselves and, have the opportunity to do fun things with people who really want to be with kids.
We're in the building that was formerly the DC General Hospital, which was in the media quite a bit last winter. Can you talk about your experience being here last winter and some of the things that have happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been running Playtime here in DC General for a couple of years, and it's been really tough. In that time, we've probably had about six different spaces that the shelter has designated for us. We started in a room designed for a family to live in, like a hospital room, and it was really cramped. And of course, we quickly reached our capacity and had to turn away children because it just wasn't safe to have more than about 15 kids in that room. And we're talking 200 to 400 children who live in the shelter. So for us to be the only children's program relegated to a tiny little hospital room was just completely insufficient. So as homelessness has grown over the past couple of years, we've really struggled as they've literally pushed us around the shelter to displacing us as they've had to fill our room with families. And after we complained a lot and asked for more appropriate space, they finally let us run our program in a cafeteria. Well, that cafeteria quickly filled with rows and rows of cots, and it was really tough to run our program for kids in a room where teenagers were doing their homework and parents were sleeping and women were coming back from the hospital with newborn babies. It was really difficult. And then finally, the room filled up with up to 20 families on cots, and there was no room for us to run our program. So we had to set up, plastic bowling pins in the hallway and hula hoops and board games on the floor and just do whatever we could. We wanted to keep our program going, even when things were bursting at the seams in the shelter. There were twice the number of families last winter over the previous winter, 200 families and 400 children. So we really struggled a lot and tried to make as much noise as we could to, you know, call attention to the fact that children in these conditions need a safe place to run around and play. And it was like we were an afterthought. Our program wasn't considered as the shelter was stretched to capacity because they constantly had a steady stream of families coming in here that needed a place to live. So, of course, that was the priority. But we really see our role as trying to sensitize the city and the shelter as to what children need who are in these environments and do what we can to make sure that they get that. So after we were displaced into the hallway and the cafeteria, the kids were complaining how loud it was. We kept asking the city for more appropriate space. And then finally this spring, we were given two rooms on the lobby level of the shelter, two empty rooms where we could design into state-of-the-art children's playrooms. So our volunteers got right to work, and on September 11th, we had a group of Greater DC Cares people come in and paint our playrooms, and we pieced together some grants and individual contributions to fill our playrooms with beautiful toys and supplies, and we set up a library for the first time and had child-centered activity stations, and we were so proud of our room, and it made such a difference to see the children see the playroom for the first time and to see the parents. We really want to create an oasis, kind of a sacred child space that communicates to them that they're worthy of having a safe and happy outlet, basically, when the rest of the shelter can feel so bleak sometimes.
And we're in one of those rooms right now, and it looks beautiful. But Jamila, it does not smell beautifully. What's going on?
It doesn't. Some of our volunteers compared it to the room where the elephants live at the zoo. There's a really pungent odor right now. And when we showed up for playtime, you know, our volunteers work full time during the day. So they're running home from work to run our children's programs. And when our volunteers opened the door to this particular playroom, it's our library and baby room, they were shocked to discover about a fourth of the room covered in an enormous puddle of what looks and smells like urine and sewage that appears to be dripping from the lights. And our beautiful paint job, as you can see along these walls, are peeling. And it's just heartbreaking because we had to close the children's this particular playroom tonight because obviously it's not safe. Our brand new rug is soaked with urine. It's dripping from the ceiling. It's pretty appalling. I don't even know what to make of it. And I don't know what words in the English language I can use when I get home tonight to email the powers that be to convince them to clean this up for us. It's pretty shocking. It's the last thing I expected to walk into tonight.
It's hard to breathe.
It is hard to breathe. It smells incredibly strong. And I can't imagine how you could possibly sanitize something as disgusting as this puddle. Oh, and look at this. This rug was brand new. This was our reading rug, and it's saturated with sewage, basically.
So what needs to happen? Who needs to be called? The stress that folks are going through in a shelter is tremendous. This space for kids is so important. Mm-hmm. One would hope that this would be a top priority to clean this up and make sure that this space is accessible for kids. Who are you going to turn to make sure that this happens?
Well, I'll start with the building staff from the Department of Human Services that oversee these kind of projects. But it's tough to hear back from them, so I'm not sure if I'll hear back from them. And I guess if I don't, I'll just keep going up the chain until I find someone that listens. And that's what I had to do to get these playrooms to begin with. It's just a lot of closed doors, a lot of ignored phone calls and emails. And it's just the squeaky wheel syndrome. I just have to keep at it. But, you know, I can't wait very long because every month we have a group of students that come in and scrub our playrooms top to bottom. And they're coming on Saturday. And our playrooms obviously need their routine cleaning, but I can't have them mess with sewage. So this is pretty unbelievable. But it's frustrating because our volunteers go above and beyond to do what needs to be done for kids, even if it's not anybody's job. And we just need the city to meet us halfway. And I know they've got a lot of challenges in this building. It's a very old building with a lot of problems where a lot of people live. But I hope that they can find a puddle of sewage in our playroom as a priority.
And overseeing the Department of Human Services, that the DC Council has oversight, and the Committee on Human Services chaired by Tommy Wells. I actually met you earlier this week at a hearing. Councilmember Tommy Wells is considering legislation that would require proof of DC residency in order for a family to get sheltered like a DC general. And so he, when you go up the chain of command, the latter might be the person that you eventually will be dealing with. But also, any thoughts on this legislation? I mean, you're someone who's dealt with families and sees the need. Any comments that you have about this legislation that might require proof of DC residency in order for an individual or family to get sheltered this winter and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, when I first heard about the legislation, I thought it intuitively made sense because I know Maryland and Virginia require similar proof of residencies, and I know that D.C. can't possibly accommodate all the families who are coming to the door of the shelter system. But then when I talked to legal advocates and really researched the issue more, I realized just what a mistake it is. It's kind of a red herring. There's so many problems with the winter plan. We saw what happened last year with poor planning, where the city finally admitted that they did not plan sufficiently for families and there were not enough beds. So you had the disaster that was people sleeping in the hallway and in the overflow cafeteria piled up on top of each other pretty much last winter. But what I'm concerned about is the city is not doing anything that I can see to prevent that from happening again. So that's why they want to remove the requirement to house families in apartment-style shelter, because they know that they can't do that right now under current budgetary constraints. So that's the piece of the legislation that I'm most specifically concerned about. But as I understand, the residency requirement is just going to add another layer of bureaucracy and make it really hard, especially for victims of domestic violence, to have to produce all this paperwork in the moment of acute crisis. It's just going to slow things down in terms of families getting what they need. And most importantly, the data just isn't there. The data doesn't support that there's this huge influx of people from the suburbs seeking shelter here. And anecdotally, honestly, I think it's the opposite. A lot of families I know are in D.C. They can't find shelter housing, so they move to sleep on a neighbor or friend's couch in PG County, Maryland, where a lot of families have relatives, and they seek help from those folks. So I think D.C. is barking up the wrong tree here. That's not going to make a huge difference in reducing the number of families seeking shelter here, and it's going to slow it up for a lot of families in acute crisis.
Your organization is in a number of shelters throughout D.C.?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are at D.C. General twice a week. We're at Turning Point Transitional Housing Program twice a week in Columbia Heights, as well as Park Road Emergency Family Shelter. We are also at Northwest Church Family Network, a transitional housing program near the Convention Center, and we're just about to start next month at DASH, District Alliance for Safe Housing, a domestic violence program run called the Cornerstone Program. So those are our five sites, and it's really interesting to see how the children's behavior responds to the different setup. For example, here at DC General, where families are so crowded and there's not a lot of services or support, we find a lot more behavior problems than we do at Turning Point, where the families can stay for 2 years and they have wraparound services and support. And the kids really relax and respond to that sense of stability, and as do the parents. So I really wish that the district would invest in more programs like Turning Point to provide the kind of stability that families need to really heal from whatever brought them into this crisis situation and help them develop the skills they need to stay out of shelters in the future. Whereas here at DC General, we're just seeing a revolving door because the families aren't getting services they need to escape homelessness, and they are continuing to struggle and stay here for much longer than they should.
Jamila, any final thoughts you want to share as we sit here in this beautiful room soaked with urine and sewage and smelling quite terribly? And also, if you could just one more time, describe the importance of playtime for these kids.
Mm-hmm. Well, DC is really proud of its educational reform efforts. We really want to be kind of a leader in the country in that movement. But what those efforts have failed to recognize as a city, we have failed to recognize the importance of where children go to sleep at night and where children wake up every morning. And how can you possibly do your homework in a building with asbestos and mold and crowded, cramped living conditions, no bathtubs? You know, how are these mothers bringing their kids home from the hospital supposed to give their babies a bath? No step stools to reach the sink. The shelter model was not set up with children in mind, but the demographics have shifted as our economy has worsened. And in D.C., I've just seen an explosion of homelessness among families. And we know that that affects children's ability to focus and learn the next day. If they're sleeping in a huge cafeteria, rows and rows of cots with babies crying and teenagers, you know, listening to music, and, you know, surrounded by strangers, how are they possibly going to get a good night's sleep and do well on their tests the next day? And for several years, we've been the only children's program here in the shelter at all. The city didn't even bother to contract or bring in community partnerships that could provide tutoring or anything like that. So I really feel like we're kind of on an island sometimes here, trying to help people understand what children need. And there have been a lot of studies that show the damaging effects of stress associated with poverty elevate children's cortisol levels, which is the stress hormone. And that has a direct impact on memory retention. It damages the hippocampus, which influences children's ability to remember. And obviously, that's a huge part of learning. So when children spend half the day just trying to recover from the stress of their night, it's going to be really hard for them to do well on those standardized tests. And the antidote to cortisol is serotonin. And kids get serotonin through exercise, through feelings of mastery, through feelings of happiness and warmth and belonging, and having an outlet to express themselves. And that's exactly what our program tries to do, to give their brains a break from the stress of living in a shelter and whatever brought them here to begin with. So I know that children need to have books and crayons and balls to play with and all of those things that we take for granted, but kids in shelters don't get unless volunteers step up to the plate and help the city understand what our children are facing.
We were outside earlier, and well, you work with younger kids. You had described what teenagers might go through living here. And a teenager walked in, someone who might be in high school and maybe ashamed to have to, not wanting friends to know that they're here. And yet your organization work with younger kids, there's really not much happening for teenagers. Can you kind of describe that situation?
Yeah. We met a lot of teenagers last year who were just kind of hanging out around the edges of our playtime, curious about what we were doing and wanting to feel engaged and to have a positive outlet. So we started talking to them, and they really begged us to get them out of the shelter and expose them to new opportunities. There's so many teenagers who live here that are completely invisible, that people don't think about teenagers being a part of homeless families and sharing rooms with their middle-aged mother and their little sister and their sometimes nephews, and all in a cramped hospital room. So we talked with a lot of teenagers who, when we asked what's the hardest part about living in a shelter, we did a survey with them to kind of assess their needs. And the number one response was hiding it from my friends, because these kids don't want their friends to know where they live. They can't have them come over, you know, at the end of a school day. So they just kind of linger outside of school, not wanting their friends to know where they're walking home. And I think of all the age groups of children who are in shelter, it obviously hits teens the worst because they know what it means. Sometimes babies and toddlers, the parents can do a good job of hiding from them, you know, what it means to be in a shelter. They can try to protect them a little bit. But for teens, it's obviously hard enough being a teen under the best of circumstances, but coming home to a shelter can be extremely stressful and distracting for their studies as well. And not to have a decent room to do homework or even a desk in their rooms makes it really tough. I mean, we're asking these kids to do well on their tests and not to have any excuses, but we're not giving them the support in city-funded institutions where they're forced to live because their families don't have any other options. So I'm really concerned that teenagers are a huge unmet need in the shelter. And we're trying to do what we can with our monthly field trip program, but I'd love to have another room on this floor that can be kind of a teen drop-in center for them to have a safe place to hang out. I think one of the most interesting aspects of our teen field trip program that they really drove and helped design was just the incredibly powerful community they developed with each other. Because developmentally, we know that's what teens need. They need to develop social relationships with each other. And they don't have that opportunity unless it's facilitated in an institution like this. So the way they bonded and supported each other was really inspiring. And even after all the kids moved out of DC General, they continued to come back to our field trips because they went through a really difficult experience together. And they were able to talk to one another about it when they might not be able to talk to anybody else.
I realized as you were talking that we've gone from one difficult subject to another, but I also wanted to convey, having watched the kids take part in the program, the little girl just running down the hallway, the joy, the mothers picking up the kids. There is such brilliance and laughter and arguing too and everything. It's just an explosion of life that is taking place.
It's true. And one thing when we do our volunteer training, we try to prepare them for anything, but we try to help them understand that these are just children, and homelessness is one aspect of something that they're experiencing, but they're children too, and it's such a privilege to be able to take part in their childhood. And we've had volunteers see kids take their first steps and talk for the first time, and it's just such a thrill to see kids have the access to the tools of childhood, and their parents are so grateful to us for providing this opportunity for them. And we love to have parents take books as they leave, so they have something that they can do up in their rooms with their families. But you're right, joy is underrated. Joy is like a birthright of childhood, and we think that's incredibly important, just as important it is to get a good education. We want kids to have a happy childhood despite being stuck in a shelter. And that's why we take our role seriously, even to foster those opportunities around the holidays. We gave out 300 Halloween costumes this year, and we had we set it up kind of like a store where the kids and parents could walk through and pick out what they wanted. And one parent, as she was serving the Halloween costumes in that dirty hallway around the corner of this former hospital, she started crying, and she just said, "My daughter's Halloween party at school is tomorrow. They have to come in costume. And I couldn't afford a costume. And, you know, now I can't. Now my daughters can pick out anything they want. And I just can't even tell you what this means to me." So even little things like that, that we might take for granted, are huge to a child's sense of self-esteem, to be able to participate in Halloween as a costumed child, which, again, is something that these kids don't have the opportunity to do very often.
I had one more concern as you were talking, which is, as we sit here in a room filled with urine, that the government may step in and say, "Oh, this is terrible. You know, we need to shut down DC General. The conditions aren't great." And while the conditions aren't great, and maybe, you know, best practices would be a smaller shelter, at this point, with the economy as it is, as it has been for some time, and looks like it may be for some time, there is a real need to do the best that we can with DC General and other larger shelters, because there is such need for housing. Are you at all concerned that by exposing some of the problems, they'll then kind of aid and abet the push to close shelters like this one down?
Everybody loves to hate DC General because they think it's an eyesore. There's some not in my backyard NIMBYism going on in the community, where people complain to Tommy Wells about families living here. So yeah, I am concerned about that, because we always have to think about what kind of community we want for the district, what we would want for ourselves if we ever became homeless as a family, what kind of services and supports we would want for our neighbors. And I can't think of another facility large enough to house 200 families, and this is as good as we got right now. So we have to make it the best possible place. I definitely get concerned when I hear about people saying we have to close down DC General, because obviously no one would choose to live here if they weren't absolutely desperate. But if we close it down, where are all those families going to go? There are more than 400 families on the waiting list for shelter. Last I heard, about 40-some families on the Tier 1 list, which means they have absolutely nowhere to go. They're sleeping in public spaces, in Greyhound bus stations, riding the Metro bus all night, sleeping under bridges. These are families with children. So DC General is a lifeline right now. It's as good as we got, unfortunately. And it frustrates me that the city doesn't want to, you know, fully invest in what it takes to run a decent shelter here, because there are families that really depend on it, and there are families that are grateful for being here, and just talk about how if they wouldn't be here, they would be in a really dangerous situation. So I think we have to love it and change it.
And walking around a bit where your project is and stuff, I wasn't expecting to be quite as well lit, clean. The security seems to treat people mm-hmm. quite well. Mm-hmm. It wasn't what I anticipated from reading the press reports from last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think we've definitely noticed an improvement in how the shelter is run since the previous contractor was expelled. So that's been really refreshing. I think the staff that's here works really hard with not enough money to do their jobs, and I found them to be much more responsive than the last contractor with returning my calls and emails. So I think, honestly, the current providers are doing the best job that they can with what they have. Having said that, I am hopeful that the future providers, because the city contract is, there's an RFP out and there's presumably going to be a new provider starting in March. I really hope that they'll get more resources to do a better job, because we have families coming to our social work intern asking for help finding job and employment, coming to me asking for that kind of help. And that kind of help, they should have in-house experts providing those services to get families out as quickly as possible. So I know that this, with the right funding and support, this place could really help families move out much quicker. But right now, they're doing the best they can with what they have. That's my feeling.
Should social workers, and if you're going to have family shelters, should playtime for children be a part, be kind of part of the discussion for each shelter? And why isn't it? If you're going to shelter and family, why aren't we talking about, and why don't you even have the conversation about the need for teenagers and children to have programming?
Yeah, I think children's needs are still invisible to a large extent in the shelter model. You know, if you're setting up a shelter with people for people with disabilities, obviously you'd have to look at all kinds of intense accountability, accessibility standards, whereas that's not looked at in the same way with families, in my observation. So it is really frustrating because you're denying the need of a teenager who's a part of a homeless shelter, who's a part of a homeless family, to have a space to do his homework, to have a safe place to be with his siblings. The teens can't be here unless their parents are here. So you have teens hanging out with their mothers at work until 10 o'clock at night. You have teenagers waiting in the lobby of the shelter for their parents to come home. It's a really shameful thing to not be able to just, you know, come home at the end of a long day at school and lay on the couch and do whatever teenagers do. Teenagers' rights are restricted, basically. All children's rights are restricted when they're living in an institution. And I think the least that the shelter can do is make it as family-friendly as possible to help parents and kids feel like they have some shred of dignity while they're in the situation.
I know I asked you this once before, but any final thoughts you have?
Well, I know the homeless shelter model was based on serving chronically homeless men, many of whom are alcoholic or who have mental health problems. And it's my understanding that...
And many of whom are looking for work, too.
Absolutely, yes. And men who are looking for work. But because that's the sense of who the population is, my sense is they want to make shelters uncomfortable to get those men out. Because if the shelters are too comfortable, then people want to live there forever. So at CCNV, where our program started, because I was doing an employee toy drive for the Children's Defense Fund, where I worked at the time.
Center for Creative Nonviolence at 2nd and D Streets,
right.
Northwest.
Yes.
Big shelter.
Yes, big shelter. And I took a tour, and I didn't see a single toy in sight. In the late 90s, there were children living there. And I had read in the Washington City paper, there was a child who discovered a dead woman's body in the bathroom. She died of whooping cough. So we thought, the employees of the Children's Defense Fund, the least we could do is give gifts to the children who live there for the holidays. I didn't see any toys. So I asked this woman, doesn't anyone ever donate any toys? I just saw rows of bunk beds and sheets for doors and kids kind of languishing in the hallways. And she said, yeah, we get toys from time to time, but we keep them locked in a closet so the kids don't make a mess. So that's literally how the Playtime Project started. We realized that it wasn't going to be enough to give toys. We had to literally provide the space for those toys to be used and the people to defend a child's right to play, to provide them that opportunity to use the room where the toys are. So we really had very, very humble beginnings, but that's where I really learned that the homeless shelter model based on serving men, they had no toilet paper in the bathrooms by choice from the shelter, no soap, because they wanted people to provide that for themselves. They didn't want people to get dependent on the shelter for anything. And here we have little babies trying to reach the sink, no soap. You know, sorry, this baby didn't bring toilet paper with them into the shelter. So it became really an eye-opening experience for me to just see how child-unfriendly even the family shelters are in some cases. I guess I'm just really frustrated that with unemployment numbers rising in D.C., you know, we have a 30% unemployment rate in Ward 8, and most of the families who come into shelters come from Ward 7 or 8, which have the highest poverty rate, the highest adult illiteracy rate, hovering around 50%.
And for folks to know, it's east of the Anacostia River.
Right. And, I mean, we have a serious problem with affordable housing in our community. And it was really frustrating. Last spring, our volunteers went to city council with parents, armed with stacks of letters that other volunteers and parents had written, protesting the cuts that the Fenty administration had proposed to all pretty much social services. Nothing but the school system was spared in these cuts. And it was so frustrating to talk to these city council members who did not have the political will to figure out alternatives to making these cuts. And now the city budget is in worse shape and homelessness continues to grow. And it's really frustrating. I just really hope that people will talk to their city council members and help them understand that we're not just thinking about ourselves. The tough economy is affecting certain segments of our population much worse than others. And it's our responsibility to really speak out for what kind of city we want to live in. Like, I don't want to live in a city that turns children and families away from a shelter or that puts, expects these beautiful children you saw here tonight to toddle around on a floor that is soaked with urine as this floor is now. I mean, obviously how we treat our children and families in the worst moments of their life says a lot about us as a city. And I just hope that we have the political will to do right by our families and get some more affordable housing in the budget and raise my taxes so you don't have to have more children in shelters suffering. I mean, it's pretty sad when we're willing to have children suffer so we can live more comfortable lives. I think that's been the most eye-opening thing for me to, as I travel around different parts of the city, you see how half of our children live. They never hear gunshots. They never have a puddle of urine sit in their living environments for days on end. I mean, it's unbelievable how we treat children and families in the city who are homeless. And it's my hope that we will do better this year than we did last year.
Recently, page one of the Washington Post, after the census came out, said that 43% of African American children in the District of Columbia are living in poverty. And then it was page one, and then it's like disappeared, like it somehow it's been solved. Mm-hmm. But that's still the case. And as you're saying, it's other parts of the city are just so wealthy. Mm-hmm. And there's a real disconnect when it comes to, I mean, the Washington Post repeatedly said, we can't understand why anyone would not vote against Fenty when things are getting better. And yet the Washington Post itself says 43% of African-American children are living in poverty. So it's really a city, as you're saying, where people are very disconnected from what's happening mm-hmm. in significant parts throughout the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge disconnect. And I feel like, yeah, the news is definitely tainted towards who the Washington Post thinks their readership are. Like, we had a man killed in our backyard a couple weeks ago, and it was really traumatizing for myself and everyone in our household to hear the gunshots kind of reverberate through our house and to see the police in the back drag the body out. And, you know, to try to sleep that night after pretty close brush with violence, and then the next day to see nothing in the paper until the afternoon, and that person didn't even deserve the dignity of a name or an age or a school until several days later, where we finally learned his name and his age, and that's it. There's so many examples of that where certain lives are valued more than others, and coming to the shelters, I see that loud and clear. When I leave the neighborhood where I live with all these beautiful playgrounds and parks and beautiful schools, and then come here to DC General and just see the trail where kids walk to the entrance of this hospital, I will never, not be shaken by walking under this old abandoned ambulance tunnel, basically surrounded by all this concrete. And that's where the children play. And with the DC jail next door and the DC morgue out back, I mean, it's a terrible place for children to grow up. And this is a lifeline for children and families. There has to be an emergency shelter. As long as there's domestic violence and unemployment and all the myriad of reasons where families become homeless, there has to be emergency shelter to provide them a safe place to be. And there needs to be the full continuum of affordable housing and more opportunities for family stability. So, yeah.
How many DC council members have come through? I mean, this to me seems like an oasis, you know, in a desert in many ways. So how much support have you seen, and how many DC council members have come and really spent time here and seen the kids and figured out ways to continue and expand programming for youth and for parents, and just figuring out ways to communicate with folks, even if they're not making campaign contributions and, you know, not testify, maybe they will start testifying. So how many council members have come through?
When we met with all the council members and their staff last spring, we invited all of them to come through. And if they weren't on the Human Services Committee, they had very little interest in what we had to say. So we only got one to come through, and that is Tommy Wells, who's the chair of the Human Services Committee and represents this ward, Ward 6, where DC General sits. So he came to our open house for our new playrooms last month. But that's it. That's all. We got a couple people running for office. They wanted, I think, the votes of some of the parents, but we haven't been able to get anyone else to visit. So we've got to take care of this puddle of urine before we have time to do some more outreach.
Well, thanks so much for your time, Jamil. Continue to follow this, and hopefully this can get cleaned up and taken care of so this beautiful room can get put back to use for children who need it.
Thank you. It was really sad to turn away so many children tonight who count on this room every Tuesday and Thursday night. So I know the kids will be anxious to have it back once it's cleaned up.
Thanks.
Thank you.